طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this morning with a response to Jared Kushner's framing of his much-anticipated new peace initiative by Professor Haider Eid, writing out of Gaza. As a, quote, native living under occupation, Haider Eid responds to the racism and condescension of Jared Kushner's preparatory statements about the pending new proposed plan, in particular, Kushner's questioning of the ability of Palestinians to govern themselves. This is what Professor Eid wrote in response. Quote, "In classical racist literature and discourse, the black-brown natives are portrayed as lazy groups who cannot run their own affairs. The best intentions of these nations amount in the end to nothing, and whatever they have is brought about by the powers of illusion and Western intervention. The racist ideology of colonialism justifies the occupation of others' lands and then defends the so-called human face of Western colonialism in general, and Israeli settler colonialism in particular." Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's Middle East advisor and son-in-law, has recently raised doubts about the ability of the Palestinians to govern themselves. He says, quote, "That's one that we'll have to see. The hope is that they, over time, will become capable of governing. The Palestinians need to have a fair judicial system, freedom of the press, freedom of expression, tolerance for all religions before the Palestinian territories can become investable." Unquote. Of course, Israel, for him, does have all these freedoms, even if he fails to acknowledge that they are exclusive to a particular ethno-religious group. He went further when asked if Palestinians could expect freedom from Israeli military and government interference by saying that it would be a, quote, high bar. For Kushner, quote, "What the Palestinian people want is they want the opportunity to live a better life. They want the opportunity to pay their mortgage," unquote. This is racism 101, taken straight from the social Darwinism of the 19th century. One classical definition of racism based on a strictly biological approach, which the likes of Jared Kushner and other white supremacists from South Africa to the American South to apartheid Israel believe in, is that human beings may be distinguished in terms of their biological makeup, and these differences result in essential innate differences in relation to intelligence. This is the rationale for racism. So based on this logic, Palestinians are not as smart as white Ashkenazi Israelis to govern themselves, let alone the fact that differences between social groupings are a function of material and historical forces. And this applies to the differences between settler colonialists and natives in Palestine. One wonders whether Kushner has ever heard of Samira Azam, Salma Kadra Jayusug, Kassan Kanafani, Mahmoud Darwish, Tawfiq Zayad, Ibrahim Abu Lugd, Isham Sarabi, Naji al-Ali, or Fadwa Tuqan, to mention but a few Palestinian minds. Palestinians for white rich kids like Kushner are not genuine and authentic human beings like Ashkenazi Israelis because they do not produce bombs and machines. Thus, they simply cannot govern themselves. But they are, of course, responsible for the tragedy in their lives from 1948 until today. Israel, with the U.S., has been trying to civilize them. Palestinians have a different mentality, inferior to that of Westerners. This is why these primitive, uncivilized Palestinians should be grateful if the Ashkenazi Israeli should be generous enough to carry the burden of governing them. Kushner's message is clear enough. Since you cannot trust Palestinians to run their own affairs, they should accept the, quote, deal of the century and their own enslavement to Israelis. Kushner's is an ideology that is not only racist, but also Islamophobic and Orientalist. I have no doubt whatsoever that he would have supported the Jim Crow laws and the apartheid regime, since he has no problem whatsoever with a new Israeli nation-state law. Let me end this piece with jewels taken from one of the greatest Palestinian thinkers of the 20th century, the late Edward Said, who noted in Culture and Imperialism that, quote, "The common factor of both colonialism and neocolonialism as constituents of imperialism is the presumption of the superiority of the white Western colonialist over the black native colonized, and the right of the former to oppress the latter, whose role is only reaffirming the superiority of the former." End of quote and end of article. That was a response of Gaza's Professor Haider Eid to the preparatory remarks of Jared Kushner as he introduced his proposed Palestine-Israel peace plan. Our feature presentation this morning is British author and journalist Ben White speaking about his new book, Cracks in the Wall, Beyond Apartheid in Israel-Palestine. He spoke at the Jerusalem Fund and Palestine Center in Washington, D.C. It begins with their executive director, Mohammed Mohammed, introducing Ben White.
After decades of occupation and creeping annexation, Israel has created an apartheid system in historic Palestine. Peace efforts have failed because of one hard truth. The best Israeli offers do not meet the minimum that a truly free Palestine would require, nor that international law would actually recognize. There are, however, widening cracks in Israel's traditional pillars of support for this policy. And in this book, Ben White lays them out. Opposition to Israeli policies, he shows, are growing within Jewish communities and among Western progressives, while the rise of populist movements around the world has confused traditional party lines on the question, and the Palestinian-led boycott campaign continues to gain momentum. Now, Ben White argues, is the time to plot a course to avoid the mistakes of the past, to create a real way forward and beyond apartheid in Palestine. So a little bit about Ben White, who most of you probably know, but for those who don't know, he's a journalist and analyst who has been visiting and writing about Palestine for more than a decade. He's the author of four books, including Israeli Apartheid, A Beginner's Guide, and his latest, Cracks in the Wall, Beyond Apartheid in Palestine-Israel. His articles have been published by The Guardian, Independent, Al Jazeera, Newsweek Middle East, and many others. He's also a contributor to Al Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. Without further ado, please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Ben White.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and thank you to Mohammed for the kind introduction, and thank you for the invitation to join you here today and share something about this new book. As Mohammed said, there'll be a time for a Q&A afterwards. So as I kind of brush through the main arguments of the book, feel free to keep in mind anything you'd like me to come back to or stuff that I haven't touched upon that you'd like me to discuss as well. The book is divided into three parts, and the argument is divided into three parts. And I'm going to say a little bit about each one of those three parts. The first part of the book takes a look at the reality on the ground in Palestine, Israel, and sketches out the contours of what exists today, which is a de facto single apartheid state between the river and the sea in all of historic Palestine, in today's Israel and occupied territories. And I go into a little bit about the political processes of the last few decades that have been part of and that have enabled Israel's de facto annexation of the West Bank in particular. The second part of the book shifts focus to an international international dimension, and particularly looking at some developments that have been taking place in the US. Those are the cracks in the wall that I talk about. These are the positive developments and trajectories, which I'll elaborate on. And the final part of the book turns back to the land itself and makes an argument drawing on and inspired by people who've been making similar arguments for some time, that what's necessary now is to think about the transformation of a de facto single state into a single democratic state. So that's the broad brushstrokes of how I'm going to talk today about the argument of the book. But I'm going to begin with the reality on the ground. And I started chapter one at a couple of points. I'm going to read some short extracts from the book. I started chapter one with recounting something that took place, some events that took place in 2010, which for me were personally quite instructive in terms of thinking about what's the reality on the ground compared to how it's sometimes discussed. It was 4:30 a.m. on the 27th of July 2010 when 1,300 armed Israeli police officers descended upon Al-Araqib, a small impoverished Bedouin Palestinian village in the Negev region of southern Israel. After blocking the entrance to the village, Israeli forces including mounted cavalry, bulldozers and helicopters forcibly removed residents from their homes, including children and elderly people. By the end of the raid, the Israeli authorities had destroyed some 45 homes, leaving more than 300 people homeless, half of them children under 16 years old. The bulldozers did not spare animal pens and chicken coops, and hundreds of trees were uprooted for replanting elsewhere. Just 2 days before the pre-dawn raid on Al-Araqib, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told government colleagues that a Negev, quote, without a Jewish majority, could constitute a palpable threat to the state. Just a few days before the bulldozers went to work in Al-Araqib, a similar scene had played out in the West Bank, as Israeli authorities tore down Palestinian homes en masse in Al-Farasiya, a herding community in the northern Jordan Valley. On the 19th of July, Israeli forces invaded the village and destroyed more than 70 structures in one fell swoop, including homes, stables, sheds, water tanks, 2 tons of animal fodder, fertilizer, and wheat. The piles of rubble and twisted metal left in Al-Araqib and Al-Farasiya over a few days in the summer of 2010 were a microcosm of the grim reality that has taken shape in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territory. For both Palestinian citizens in the Negev and Palestinians in the West Bank, under military rule, Israeli authorities carry out displacement and dispossession with a rubber stamp of due process. The Green Line, the post-49 armistice line distinguishing between territory held by Israel before and after 1967, has been erased in practical terms, and the reality on the ground is that of a single regime. Now, I'm sure that people here today or watching online will be familiar with aspects of what this de facto single apartheid state means for Palestinians. But just as a quick overview to remind us, in the West Bank, those Palestinians under a military regime, their lives really are dominated by the presence of 200-plus illegal Israeli settlements, including both official Israeli government sanctioned settlements, as well as the so-called unauthorized outposts. In East Jerusalem, again, Palestinians, almost all of whom who have got a Jerusalem ID, not Israeli citizenship, have their lives characterized by systematic discrimination, particularly with respect to land and housing and so on. Palestinian citizens of Israel inside the 67 lines again, contrary to many widely held perceptions, have also always experienced systematic institutionalized discrimination, including long before the Jewish nation state law that was passed last year. Palestinians in the Gaza Strip experience Israeli apartheid at its most brutal, through the ongoing occupation and the blockade, but also through the periodic devastating Israeli assaults, and as we've seen in almost precisely the last 1 year, the use of Israeli army snipers against civilian demonstrators. And for Palestinian refugees, outside of historic Palestine altogether, of course, this de facto single state prevents them from returning home. Now, as I wrote the first part of this book, I wanted to go beyond just this kind of factual description of how things are now and to look a little bit into how that's come to be. And one of the things that I was struck by was how this has, Israel's de facto annexation of the West Bank has just proceeded sort of in plain sight, really. I don't know how many people here have heard a warning along the lines of the door is closing on the two-state solution, or this is the last opportunity for a Palestinian state, or the window is closing, something like this. And normally that kind of warning is talking about, or is focused on, the issue of Israeli settlement population numbers, or the size of Israeli settlements themselves, how much land they're taking up in the West Bank, and so on and so forth. Former Israeli deputy mayor, Meron Benvenisti, once warned an American audience that in terms of preventing Israel's irreversible hold on the West Bank, the time was, quote, 5 minutes to midnight. And he said that in 1982 in D.C. Now, that was 15 years after Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip had begun. And that warning has been repeated time and time again. And as I was thinking about that, one of the reflections it led to is a sort of a question about just how useful or illuminative it is when discussing the feasibility or probability of a Palestinian state being established in the occupied territories. How useful is it to focus on settlement numbers and settlement size? The idea that there might be some magic cutoff point beyond which it's not possible to have a Palestinian state anymore. Is there maybe a better way of analysing that and looking at that? Around the same time that a few years after Meron Benvenisti made those remarks in 82, Professor Ian Lustig, a US Middle East Studies professor, he wrote a report actually commissioned by the US government, by the Defense Department, on this exact same topic, the idea or wanting, Ian Lustig was asked to look at the extent to which Israel's hold on the occupied territories was already sort of past this point of no return. And Ian Lustig argued already at that point that instead of looking at settlement numbers, which obviously back then were much smaller anyway, he said it was better to look at different kinds of thresholds, such as institutional thresholds and what he referred to as psychocultural thresholds, in other words, the extent to which the Jewish Israeli public, or at least the majority of them, view the West Bank as much as part of Israel as, say, the Galilee or something like that. So I thought those kinds of observations, I think, are still have a lot of utility today in terms of where we place the focus on our analysis. And the other thing that I thought was interesting was the way in which, potentially counterintuitively, potentially not, the official, mainly US-led peace process has also been one of the factors that has helped Israel to de facto annex the West Bank. And one of the ways in which that's worked is that the politics of the peace process and the framing of the peace process puts in the future, on the horizon, a Palestinian state. And it presupposes that there'll be some Israeli withdrawal from the occupied territories, or at least from most of them. But precisely as that's been on the hypothetical horizon, Israel's been doing all it can to make sure that it never will withdraw from the occupied territories. But this sort of the idea that at some point Israel will has been one of the things that's shielded Israel from the accountability for the apartheid system that exists today. Boris Johnson, when he was the British Foreign Secretary a couple of years ago, went to Israeli occupied territories on official business, and he said something like, paraphrasing him slightly, he said, "You know, without a Palestinian state, this will be an apartheid situation." It was very similar, and he used the A word. Very similar language to what John Kerry had used when he was still Secretary of State. Even someone like Ehud Barak had said something, again, very similar a few years before that. But what they're describing is now. Okay, they're saying if Israel controls the lives of millions of Palestinians who can't vote in the only parliament that matters between the river and the sea, the Knesset, then this would be an apartheid reality. But that's what exists today, and it didn't turn up yesterday or last week or last month. It's been the case for many, many decades. And the only reason they're really able to talk about it in this hypothetical sense is because of the political framework of the so-called peace process and the horizon that it, you know, supposedly provides for an Israeli withdrawal. Just before I move on to some sort of more good news, as it were, I also just wanted to mention one other bit that I sort of conclude that part of the book with, which is an honest reflection on the political impasse that there exists now, and in particular, an honest appraisal of what's actually on the table from the Israeli side of things with regards to the Palestinians. And broadly speaking, there are three camps, and you see them reflected in the current in the election that's going to happen soon. You've got the camp that basically wants the status quo, and I think probably Netanyahu, you know, maybe sits in this camp the best. I mean, these are not hard and fast boundaries, but you've got the camp that likes the status quo. It thinks that there's nothing particularly wrong about the status quo. There are advantages, there are risks to making any radical changes, and so on and so forth. Then you've got people within Likud, and of course also within other parties even further to the right, who are advocating for partial or total formal annexation of the West Bank. And then you've got those who advocate so-called separation, mainly represented in Israeli opposition parties currently. And I say they're advocating separation, not Palestinian statehood, because in the main, those elements are not talking about the parameters or contours of a genuinely sovereign Palestinian state or Palestinian self-determination, but are instead offering a model from their point of view of separating Palestinians from the Jewish-Israeli citizenry and population. So that's really what you've got on the table. You have status quo, annexation, and separation. And as Mohammed mentioned in the introduction, the sort of core reason for why there has been no progress on the big picture political front is because the maximum that's ever been on offer from the Israeli side has never approached the minimum that Palestinians can accept or the standards of international law. So I'm going to skip now onto the second part of the book, because having looked a bit at that grim reality, I then shift focus to this more exciting or positive trajectories that are taking place everywhere, or internationally speaking, but particularly in the US. And the argument is that these cracks in the wall, these developments, individually but also especially taken together, can, won't necessarily, but can threaten and undermine Israel's ability to perpetuate and maintain the status quo. So the first crack in the wall that I look at is the fragmentation and divisions that are taking place in the American Jewish community over Israel, over the Palestinians, over even Zionism itself. And there's a lot of ways in which that is manifesting. Part of that is not actually very recent at all, although it's tended to generate more headlines in sort of the last few years. But these are long-standing developments in many cases. They're not all related either, actually, to the so-called conflict, but are also related to issues of religious pluralism and things like this. But in terms of how it pertains to Palestine, there are significant things taking place. I'll just read out a brief little extract from the chapter that I wrote looking at this, because it was just a useful microcosm of what's happening. So this is looking back to the summer of 2017. In June 2017, the 50th anniversary of Israel's military occupation of the West Bank and Gaza Strip provided an insight into elements of the current divide. For some, it was an occasion of unabashed celebration, while for others, the anniversary marked the start of the occupation and remains a deeply complicated and conflicted milestone, quote unquote, and some saw nothing at all to celebrate. On the one hand, 4th of June saw New York celebrates Israel Day with a parade down Fifth Avenue and a Celebrate Israel festival sponsored by the Israeli-American Council. On the other hand, the young Jewish American group, If Not Now, organized public demonstrations all across the country designed to force the American Jewish community to reckon with what it means to have supported the occupation for the past 50 years, end quote. Two very different delegations were also a microcosm of this divergence. One saw the former British Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks lead a trip that included participation in the March of the Flags on so-called Jerusalem Day and a dance with Israeli soldiers in Hebron. That same summer, more than 100 activists from Jewish communities abroad, mainly the US, participated in a Samud freedom camp to rebuild a demolished Palestinian community in the West Bank. So you can see institutional manifestations of these fragmentations with the emergence over the last decade or so or more of groups like J Street, groups like Jewish Voice for Peace. I mean, not all of these developments and phenomenon should be viewed uncritically by Palestinians and their allies, but they are all significant with respect to the opportunities that they are providing and the impact that they are having on wider processes. The second crack in the wall that I talk about, and I'm going to give an example of how these all relate to each other in a moment. The second crack in the wall is the end of the era, or the ending of the era, of uncritical bipartisan support for Israel in DC amongst Democrats and Republicans. And again, this reflects trajectories that are not new, that have been going on for some time, but are now starting to come to the fore, reflecting grassroots organizing by Palestinians and their allies in the US, reflecting also the sort of radicalization of elements of the Republican base too, including, of course, Christian Zionist support for Israel. But now the data is overwhelming, right? Now, and this is a topic that has started to, in the last sort of year or two especially, gain mainstream coverage, mainstream awareness. The polling is part of this data, and there is regular polling that looks at what, you know, the Democratic voter, the Republican voter, what they think about Israel, what they think about the US's relationship to Israel and the Palestinians. And that divergence is obvious in this polling. One poll that I included in my book, which I thought was particularly striking, was a poll conducted by YouGov, published in the New York Times in early 2017. And American adults were asked to rate whether a country was an ally or enemy of the US on a 5-point scale. Israel dropped to 16th place from 6th in 2014, so just 3 years before that, a significant enough development. But even more striking was the vast disparity between Republicans and Democrats, who placed Israel 5th and 28th, respectively. Okay? I think almost an unparalleled or unique disparity with respect to perceptions of a country's relationship to the US. As I was writing this book in 2017, one of the things that took place that for me epitomized and embodied a lot of these developments that are taking place, and actually acted as a catalyst for them too, was the nomination by Donald Trump of David Friedman to be the US ambassador. Now, it embodies that whole story, embodies actually the negative trajectory on the ground in terms of Friedman's support for the settlement enterprise and how the Trump administration is pursuing clearly a variety of policies that are designed to rubber stamp the de facto single apartheid state. But the nomination also embodied some of the positive developments in terms of the response to it. And Friedman's confirmation hearing, which some of you may remember in the Senate, was, you know, admittedly, I'm not familiar with the history of all ambassadorial Senate confirmation hearings, but my sense was that this was a reasonably unusual event, and it's what I begin the whole book with in the introduction. It was a Senate hearing like no other. David Friedman, US President Donald Trump's nominee for the position of ambassador to Israel, had been speaking for about 20 seconds when he was loudly interrupted by a man holding a Palestinian flag. Mr. Friedman also said that Palestinian refugees don't have a claim to the land, don't have a connection to Palestine, the man shouted. My grandfather was exiled, was kicked out by the State of Israel. As he was led out by police officers, Tahar Hatzalah of American Muslims for Palestine managed one last parting shot. We aren't going away, Mr. Friedman. We are there, we were there, we are there now, and we will always be there. Palestinians will always be in Palestine. After an awkward silence, Friedman resumed. But this was just the first of a series of interruptions. 2 minutes later, fellow AMP staffer Karim El-Husseini stood up and protested Friedman's support for Israel's illegal settlements in the West Bank. Waving a Palestinian flag, El-Husseini was also removed and arrested. Before Friedman could get to the end of his opening statement, he was subjected to an equally dramatic interruption by three members of If Not Now, a group started in 2014 by young Jewish Americans in the context of so-called Operation Protective Edge. You promote racism, fund illegal settlements, one man shouted. We will not be silenced. You do not represent us, and you will never represent us. Another activist stood and stated loudly, Israeli occupation is an injustice against Palestinians and a moral crisis for American Jews. Moral American Jews stand against occupation and against Friedman. So that whole episode, and it also played out in public with some Jewish American organizations taking a stand against the nomination, some not saying anything at all and some supporting it. The fact that the final confirmation vote was split down party lines as well really embodied the way in which these trajectories and developments have come to the fore, have come to the public gaze more, and the way in which the Trump administration is also acting as a catalyst for these developments, all of which are developments that the smarter Israelis, policy-wise, understand represent a so-called strategic threat to their ability to maintain the apartheid status quo. The third crack in the wall that I talk about is the BDS campaign, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions campaign. Started in 2005 by 100-plus Palestinian civil society organizations. In its essence, it is the same as many civil society-based boycott campaigns that have existed around the world at different places at different times, whether in terms of international solidarity or whether in terms of just also like localized campaigning. Everybody is familiar with the concept of a boycott and why that works, why it's necessary in certain situations where moral persuasion or other factors haven't worked. A boycott is intended to bring about a cost to an unjust status quo, and the Palestinian boycott call is no different in that sense. The BDS movement was launched with three demands that intentionally did not refer to a future political framework, one state, two states, but referred instead to Palestinian people's rights. They referred to the demand for an end to occupation and the dismantling of the apartheid wall, the right for Palestinian citizens of Israel to live without systematic discrimination, and the right for Palestinian refugees to return and have compensation. And since the launch of that campaign in 2005, it's become a genuinely global civil society-based campaign, with support in labor movements and trade unions, cultural workers, artists, academics, students, and also just amongst local communities where people have rallied, for example, where a local authority is tendering a contract and you want to make sure that a company that is complicit in, for example, the settlement enterprise doesn't win a particular bid. So that campaign has grown and, in my opinion, misguided, either disingenuously or otherwise, misguided critiques of the BDS campaign focus on the way in which the Israeli economy is robust and examines the impact of the BDS campaign purely from an economic perspective. To my mind, that's a misreading of actually the strategy, indeed, and the politics of the BDS campaign. Of course, ultimately, it is about having an economic impact. The S in BDS is for sanctions, and the idea is, and that's something that states have to ultimately impose. But the BDS campaign was intended to and has achieved important things with respect to, for example, discourse. Okay, it's made the discourse about rights. It's introduced a discourse that looks at the situation not in terms of, say, state building, it's struck a blow against the sort of the false symmetry discourse by providing people with analysis that focuses more on settler colonialism and apartheid and occupation. It's energized solidarity campaigners, and I think it's particularly important, actually, at a time when there is also internal crises in the Palestinian arena and where it's difficult for people to actually look to see sort of who to take a lead from. And by framing it about rights, by making it about accountability, it gives people something to do, something important and substantive to do, irrespective of internal Palestinian political dynamics as well. And as that's grown, Israeli officials and pro-Israel bodies sort of woke up to the threat it poses, threat in inverted commas, because yes, it is a threat, but not in the way that it's portrayed, but in the sense that it's a threat to the apartheid status quo. And over the years, recent years, a reasonable amount of resources have been mobilized by the Israeli state to try and counter the BDS movement. And at a sort of discursive level, the main tactic has been to associate or smear the BDS campaign as either a form of quote-unquote extremism or as a form of quote-unquote anti-Semitism. Personally speaking, I think the main reason why it's seen as a threat is because of its focus on accountability. Israel has been able to dispossess, dehumanize Palestinians for decades because of impunity, because of the fact that it's enjoyed impunity in many different sort of ways that that's manifested itself. And the BDS campaign is about ending that impunity. It was intentionally launched a year after the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion on the illegality of the apartheid wall, and the fact that despite that and many other resolutions and legal opinions, there is a lack of enforcement. So those three developments that have been taking place, to differing ways, long-standing developments, but starting to come to a fore, and particularly into public consciousness too, the divisions and fragmentations in the Jewish American community, the Democrat-Republican split, and in fact, the wider political polarization on this issue that is a part of, which is also taking place in other countries, and the BDS campaign. Those are three developments that are not just causing Israel problems in the short term, but actually I would suggest are genuine provide a genuine risk for Israel and undermine traditional pillars of Israel's support. So having looked at the apartheid reality on the ground today, taken that sort of sidestep to look at those positive developments outside, the last part of the book switches the focus back to what's happening on the ground. And the final part of the book makes an argument for a single democratic state. Now, in a reasonably short book, and in the last part of it, the aim was never to provide a blueprint or a sort of comprehensive argument for why this is a model that is worth pursuing. But what I did hope to do was to look at a few specifics and also, I guess, above all else, to help people imagine and conceptualize that this is something that is essential to consider seriously. I look a little bit about issues like the democratic constitutions, the way in which there is very interesting and vital reference points that already exist, thanks to work done by Palestinian citizens of Israel with respect to a democratic constitution, the issue of the refugees' return, and so on. For me personally, when I've engaged with this issue, the issue of the refugees' return has been one of the most important ones for me in my own education process and thinking about sustainable and just models sort of going forward. And I'll just read out a little bit from this last chapter that touches upon that. This end chapter is called Self-Determination, Not Segregation. When I went to Palestine for the first time in 2003, I broadly understood the Palestinian question in terms of a struggle against military occupation and for statehood. One day I was speaking with my students after an English class in Bethlehem, and a resident of Dehesha refugee camp asked rhetorically, "Why can't I go home?" And what I realized then, and my understanding of this truth has only deepened since, is that this question remains in the air, a stark, unanswered challenge, no matter how many efforts are made to smother it. For the State of Israel and the Zionist movement, the return of Palestinian refugees constitutes the undoing of the miracle of the Nakba, an end to the Jewish majority created for displacement and discrimination. Seen outside the lens of this demographic anxiety, however, the power of the Palestinians' return is transformative rather than destructive. Drawing on the arguments of many amazing scholars and activists over the years, I try and introduce some of those signposts towards a single democratic state, to argue that attempts at resolving this question through ethnic partition have been a manifest failure, and it's critical to do some big thinking that involves, for example, decoupling self-determination from ethnic statehood, that looks at making a distinction between what are perhaps illegitimate demands and legitimate rights, a way that looks and understands that from a practical point of view, you're talking about a single territorial unit with respect to water resources, topography, the religious and cultural landscape of the land as well. And that really, as I was saying with some people before, that from the point of view of practicalities, I would say that the burden of proof lies more on those who are advocating partition of the land and a two-state solution to prove that is in fact practical. But like I said, the last part of the book is really for me about trying to imagine something different, and to put in, to sort of put on the table and move into the conversation something that has been long marginalised, particularly at the official level and at policy level as well. So I am going to finish by, before we have plenty of time for discussion, I'm going to finish by reading out the last part of the very end of this book, which hopefully gives an idea of where I'm coming from in terms of this vision. This one state is not so hard to imagine, especially when you travel around that land, as I've done on and off over the last 15 years, it's more now, as this book has been at pains to describe. A de facto single state already exists and has for some time. Only it is an apartheid one defined by harsh boundaries of inclusion and exclusion, whose power structures are shaped by the politics and priorities of settler colonialism. It is a landscape of walls and watchtowers. Yet these visible and concrete divisions can, counterintuitively but undeniably, speak to and evidence a kind of intimacy, albeit one that has for decades now been of a dark sort, the closeness of a coloniser and colonised, master and slave. And it is precisely in the acknowledgement of this bond, through an unflinching inventory of what Zionism and the State of Israel has meant for the Palestinians, that it is possible to imagine the transformation of the settler and native into citizens. A book which moved me very much when I first read it is Murid Barghouti's memoir, I Saw Ramallah, based on the poet's return to Palestine after an enforced absence of some 30 years. Quote, "When Palestine is no longer a chain worn with an evening dress, an ornament or a memory or a golden Quran," Barghouti recounts telling a friend, "when we walk on Palestinian dust and wipe it off our shirt collars and off our shoes, hurrying to conduct our daily affairs, our passing, normal, boring affairs, when we grumble about the heat in Palestine and the dullness of staying there too long, then we will really have come close to it." Later he writes, "The Palestinian has his joys too. He has his pleasures alongside his sorrows. He has the amazing contradictions of life because he is a living creature before being the son of the 8 o'clock news." A single democratic state thus offers something extraordinarily ordinary. The prospect of Jewish Israelis and Palestinians escaping what Edward Said called the iron circle of inhumanity created by the radical Zionist distinction between privileged Jews in Palestine and unprivileged non-Jews, moving beyond apartheid and instead cooperating and arguing, loving and hating, praying and protesting, working and resting, living, in other words, as equal citizens of a shared home. Thanks very much.
You have been listening to British author and journalist Ben White speaking in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. To hear the program later in the day or to listen at any other time of the week via the archive found on the WZBC homepage, simply click on Archive and go to Sunday morning, 8 a.m., and click on Listen. However, each program is temporarily on this archive for only 2 weeks. After 2 weeks, to reach our permanent archive to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archives. It is all there due to the diligence of our colleague Stan Robinson. Thanks for listening, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts, and this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.